Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, urging nations to adopt an international convention protecting the work and rights of fishermen, where the Vatican stands on the issue. And we go into St. Peter's Basilica to talk to its general manager. How to do crowd control with some 20,000 visitors and more a day. Plus, tips for clergy on how to celebrate Mass there. Open seas for days and sometimes weeks or even months at a time, with shoddy living conditions, little time to rest, spoiled food to eat, and sometimes mistreatment by the ship's crew or captain. That's sometimes the sort of millions of men and women who make a living from fishing. More fishers die on the job than workers in almost any other profession. And sometimes, instead of receiving a just wage, they're given a share of the value of the fish they help catch. Until now, no international legislation has protected the working conditions of the world's fishers. But now, under the UN umbrella, 437 countries in June 2007 overwhelmingly agreed to a new convention for fishermen. But not one nation has yet ratified it. And that, says the Vatican office responsible for the apostleship of the sea, must change.
Regarding both maritime transport and fishing, the ILO adopted some important conventions in 2006 and 2007 that represent a great opportunity for the maritime world. Now the apostleship of the sea needs to carry out a task of advocacy around the world, so that these conventions will be ratified and have force of law as soon as possible.
Archbishop Agostino Marchetto is secretary of the Pontifical Council for Migrants.
For the first time in the world history, it is feared that fish will disappear from the seas. Since more than a billion people depend on fishing for their food needs, and an estimated 41 million people work directly in this activity. The exhaustion of fish resources represents, therefore, a very great danger for all these people. Entire communities of fishers are threatened with extinction. The workers of the sea tend to work and act individually. This is why their voice is rarely heard on the national or international level. It is also AM's duty to be the voice of the voiceless by helping them to become aware of the situation they are living and the deadlines they will have to face. It is also a duty to always be close and have solidarity with all the living forces working in this sector for the good and dignity of man.
Ted Richardson is one of those who's calling for the ratification of the new Convention for the Good and Dignity of Fishermen. He's regional director of the Apostleship of the Sea in Oceania. I asked him why no one has signed this important protocol.
I struggle to understand the rationale in things like the ILO.
Which is the International Labour Organization.
Yeah, which will sit down and thrash out a fundamental right of every person to care for what they need, what their minimum standards of working and conditions and environment that they work in it should be like. And all the countries will say, this is great, we have a document here that we can call Convention 188. And then they make recommendations for minimum standards of wages, food, these sorts of things for people. And they put a recommendation to it. And then it gets put on a shelf. 2 years later, we get this recommendation and this convention coming out to us, and it says, well, how many nations have ratified? Since they all agreed to it, how many nations have ratified? None. Not a one.
So all these nations, though, are involved in the production of this convention.
Yeah.
However, none of them wants to sign up to it.
No. It's just because they say, well, we've done our work.
Our consciences are clear.
Mm-hmm. We've said what the minimum standards are here. Who's going to be the first one to ratify it? And they all sit back and wait for somebody else to be the first one. And everyone says, well, we've got better standards than this in our country anyway, so why bother ratifying it? The point of ratifying is that it makes it law that people can't abuse somebody else's labour. That if a ship came to my country and we've ratified this, we have the power to say, hang on, we've got you. We can fine you under our law because we've ratified this ILO convention. So we can actually seize your vessel, we can take your stock, we can charge you with breaking the law. But at the moment we say, it's none of our business, you know, you can have a 10-year-old child working on a fishing vessel and nothing we can do about it.
But presumably many of these countries, as you say, have their own individual legislation that guarantees that a 10-year-old child is not working.
Yeah.
On a sea vessel.
And we have it in Australia. We have minimum standards for Australians working on these ships. The National Director of India was telling me that their minimum level of somebody working on a ship is 18 years of age. But if another ship came in with a child of 10 or 8, nothing they can do because they've not ratified this. So they can't say, sorry, you can't have that person working on that ship. It is illegal to have that person working on that ship. And until you employ people at the right age, we won't let your vessel go.
So explain this to me a little bit better. A ship comes in from Southeast Asia or something into an Australian port. It has a 10-year-old child working on board. Mm. The Australian port authorities are not allowed to do anything about it?
No. It's under a different country's rules and regulations.
But it's on Australian territory.
Yeah, but we've not ratified the convention, so we have no power to inspect it. Our maritime safety authorities cannot go on board the ship and look at the food conditions or look at the sleeping conditions on board the ship or the minimum age of the employees on the ship or how they're paid or how they're sustained. They have no authority to do anything other than say, is your ship seaworthy? Will it sink in our waters? If it won't sink in our waters, then off you go again.
So why aren't countries signing up for this?
I struggle to understand why.
They just don't want to be bothered. It's an extra police and security cost.
Yeah. They write the legislation for the ILO, and then it goes into a shelf, and it sits there. And the guys in the ILO struggle themselves to get these things out into the public. They come to us in the Pontifical Council meetings and said, we need to ask your help to get this to your governments so that your governments can understand from you that this is needed, because they're not listening to us. We're just the ILO. We might have a nice big logo and a nice big place that we all come to meet, but unless you do it in your country, it's not going to happen. We can scream and yell, but they're not going to listen to us. They'll only listen to you and your people because you're the voters. You're the ones that put the governments in power, and you're the ones that can take them out. And we can't do anything but ask them, please, can you ratify this? So we need to rattle cages in our governments. And every nation needs to look at these conventions and resolutions and say, adopt them. They're not so hard. You've already agreed to them. You've already had them on the table. You've read them all and you've said, yes, we agree to them. Adopt them. Make them work.
What are some of the things that are contained in this convention?
The main things are minimum age.
It's called, actually, I see the brochure here, it's called Decent Working Conditions, Safety and Social Protection, Working in Fishing Convention.
Yeah. That is basically exactly what it says. It's the working conditions, what hours that people are made to work. They can't work people for 22 hours a day. They have a minimum food requirement and safe food, that they're not eating spoilt food, that young people are not bought into the industry below a certain age, that they have an education, that they are trained and educated in the work that they're undertaking, that they have the ability to be able to go ashore, to spend time, to make sure their families are fairly compensated for that person's employment, then that person gets compensated well for their employment as well. These are just the minimum standards that we should have, that we expect in our jobs. In the first world, that we look for a job, we know when we go for an interview for a job that we're going to have a certain amount of hours that we're going to be working for, that we will have a morning tea and a lunch, that we will have a time that we will knock off and go home, that we'll have a weekend, or we're paid overtime, or
health insurance, retirement, all
yeah,
that sort of thing.
Superannuation, and whether you're compensated if you're injured at work.
Mm. But what about these? But isn't this quite onerous for many governments if they have to start policing or investigating to see whether even, you know, small family-run businesses, fishing vessels and so on, who might have one or two or three or four people working together? Isn't that maybe perhaps one of the reasons why governments haven't signed up to this? Because it's quite an onerous thing.
In some ways you could say yes, but if you're looking at a family business, then a family work at making it better for the family. They work at looking after each other. They care about each other. They're not going to work one of their family into the ground to say, you know, you keep slaving away so that, you know, I can have some time off or I can go on a holiday. So a family business is probably a good analogy for governments to look at to say, would I look after my children this way? Would I treat my kids this way? Let's make sure that if you need a doctor, we make sure we get you to a doctor. You need good food, let's make sure I get you good food, not feed you poorly, not treat you poorly.
Do you ever get in this work that you do jaded? Do you ever feel, I'm fighting for the rights of these people and nothing's happening?
It becomes frustrating at times when you feel like often you're just a voice in the wilderness, you know, crying out, say, come on, do something. You get annoyed. And then all of a sudden you get a seafarer comes up to you and he'll say, thank you. And it'll just be, thank you for what? I didn't do anything. You did a lot for me. You spoke for me. You talked for us as fishers. You talked for us as seafarers. We heard you on the radio or we read something about you in the newspaper, and you have nothing to gain by talking for us. And you talk for us. And just to get one person to say thank you just builds you up to say, I can fight harder, I can work harder, I can do more. Because you know you've made an effect on somebody. Maybe somebody you've never met, somebody you will never ever see, but you know that in your heart you've made something better for somebody else somewhere else. And that's the important thing that we should all have in our life, that whether you're a radio presenter here in the Vatican and you don't see a seafarer ever in your life, you know that through this media, you have touched a seafarer. You have touched somebody. You've made their life better. And in doing that, you've improved the world. You've made it better for seafarers. The listeners that listen to the broadcast will go and talk to somebody else, will talk to a family member and say, I heard this. I now know what this is about. And I can do something. So in every way you do something, you improve it. So that builds you up as a person. You say, we can make a difference, whether we're one or whether we're many. We can make a difference, and we do.
Ted Richardson is Regional Director of the Apostleship of the Sea for Oceania. If you lived through them, you'll never forget them. The hot spring days following Pope John Paul II's death in April 2005, when millions of pilgrims patiently lined Rome's streets to pay their last respects to the Pope so many loved. Millions poured through St. Peter's Basilica to mourn the Pope lying in state, and in the years to follow his funeral, even more have quietly queued to pray at his tomb in the Basilica's grottos. Just how does the Vatican manage such enormous crowds, over and above the normal daily flow of tourists and pilgrims? Well, I asked Cristina Carlostella, general manager of the Fabrica, or Fabrique, of St. Peter's, how security has changed over the last few years. She also gives a tip or two for clergy who'd like to celebrate Mass in the Basilica.
The visitors flow has been absolutely enormous after John Paul II's death. And that has caused quite a number of preoccupations and worries, because it is the management of crowds, which is, I think, one of the major problems that quite a number of administrations have to deal with right now. The Fabrique of St. Peter is not really involved in that aspect. Let me explain this. For the crowds that are walking into the Basilica, it is actually the security bodies of the Italian state and of the Vatican police that actually manages that at the St. Peter Square level.
Let me just explain to our listeners that since 2001, after the September 11th attacks, we who work in the Vatican have gradually seen greater security around the Basilica, around Piazza San Pietro, St. Peter's Square. We, in the last few years, have now been seeing it's been cordoned off with a chain link fence all around the outside of the Basilica. Even the colonnade around the outside of the square have now also been fenced off with metal fences. And you'll find police, Italian police, in little carts going around the square and providing security around the perimeters, especially of the square. So we have seen these major changes, unfortunately, in the last few years. And people are having to go into the square through metal detectors now as well. So explain, though, actually getting into the Basilica and into the grottos, what do tourists or pilgrims have to face?
Well, once they've passed through the security checks, as I said, managed by the Italian police in St. Peter's Square, they have to leave all their packages or bags in a guardaroba area, which is a cloakroom, and then they can access inside the Basilica. And even in the Vatican grottos, they can go freely into that space once they have passed that security check. Now,
sorry, but is it one line? Because it's been a while since I've had to go through there. It's two lines. One line to get into the Basilica and another line to get into the grotto?
No, it's the same. I'm sorry, it is the same. It is the same line. Basically, what happens is that we do have a merge area on the right-hand side of the narthex of the Basilica, and that is for visitors or groups coming from the Vatican museums into the Basilica. Now, that is an area where we also have a checkpoint, let us say, a small little checkpoint, so that we are sure that visitors coming from the Vatican museums have left all their bags and then can accede into the Basilica proper. But besides this other check control in St. Peter's Square, there are no other controls. We do have visitors who would just like to go to the cupola, for example, who would just like to go up and get this extraordinary experience of going up to that height and getting this panorama, this splendid panorama of Rome from the cupola. Now, the cupola is managed by the Fabrique of St. Peter. So that is another, let us say, crucial checkpoint. You've got the ticket office to the cupola, and that's where we have some San Pietrini who actually control the tourist flow and the visitors flow to the cupola.
You have to explain the San Pietrini. It means little St. Peter's, but it also has another meaning, doesn't it?
Yeah, San Pietrini is the term that is affiliated to the workmen, that actually, the custodians, let us say, of the Basilica, San Pietrini. Now, San Pietrini is also the same term that is used for the cobblestones around Rome. And these are the square little cobblestones that you have all over the pavements, the road pavements in Rome. It's called San Pietrini. So I always joke with our San Pietrini of the Fabrica that I think that the other San Pietrini, that is the road pavement, are terrible, but not our San Pietrini, because our San Pietrini are really, we do have now, I'm not just speaking as the general manager, but really we're very proud of our San Pietrini staff, because they do an excellent job. They run work shifts that are very heavy sometimes, 24-hour, for example, when John Paul II died, those days, which were very, very moving, it was a very moving experience, but we had a work shifts 24-hour round the clock within the Basilica because of all those faithful and visitors that were coming to pay their respects to John Paul II. So they really are a fantastic group of men who really dedicate their entire, life to the San Pietro. I mean, they have such a veneration and devotion to St. Peter themselves that is just really very moving to have such motivated group of people.
Now, they're the ones who are responsible for setting up the altar on the steps outside this basilica when the Pope gives a special mass outside, or for all the events held in St. Peter's Square as well?
Well, there we do also share the responsibility with Governatorato, La Floreria Vaticana, for example. There are quite a number of teams of workmen that, we try to sort of share and help each other out there. But most of the San Pietrini's role and job is the surveillance of the basilica proper, so inside the basilica or at the entrance of the basilica. And they carry out, of course, all the maintenance work. And again, there, for example, in setting up for the liturgies, the mass liturgies within the basilica, you do have a very strong cooperation with these other teams of workmen that are from the Vatican, from the Governatorato. They're managed by the Governatorato. So Governatorato and Fabrica of St. Peter very much collaborate very strongly when we have to set up the interior of the basilica for liturgical ceremonies or for other events. But just the custodian aspect, that is just surveilling the inside the basilica, that's up to the San Pietrini and the Fabrica in St. Peter.
And are you also the ones, or they would be the ones, who set up the nativity scene and the big Christmas tree in St. Peter's Square at Christmas time?
No. Actually, the one that's in St. Peter's Square is actually designed and set up by the Governatorato. But, however, there is a competition every year, because our San Pietrini have had, by tradition, the task of setting up another crèche scene inside the basilica. And with all respect to the crèche scenes in St. Peter's Square, I have to say that the crèche scenes designed by, especially in recent years, designed by our own San Pietrini, is really very, very beautiful. I won't put a comparison there, but I have to say that every year I find myself congratulating our San Pietrini also for the aesthetic level and the loving care that they put in setting up that crush scene inside the basilica. It's usually in the chapel area or the area right after the baptistry, to the left hand side, to the small nave on the left of the inside the basilica.
We'll tell our listeners, if they're here in Rome at Christmas time, to check that out.
Absolutely, because every year they put an element that's different every year. So I think last year they put a waterfall. A real waterfall, a small little waterfall in the crèche scene. And it was very, very beautiful.
Are you in charge in any way for the little individual liturgies that go on, the daily masses in St. Peter's, also the confessions in the various languages?
For the confessions, not really, because you do have the penitenceria of the Vatican that really takes care of that. The management, that is the cleaning, the maintenance of the confessionals, yes, that is up to us. For the daily masses, it's really up to the Vicariato, the Vatican Vicariate office, that actually runs that. But of course, the Archpriest of the Basilica of St. Peter is also the head, of course, is our Archpriest of the Canons of St. Peter. And so together with that group, the canons, and also the Vicariate office, whose headquarters are also here in the headquarters of the Fabrique, we do manage the daily mass liturgies. The one superior who's actually really looks after this area is the delegate of the Fabrica di San Pietro. He is the one who actually looks after the programming together with Cardinal Comastri in the daily mass schedule. Priests who come from all over the world can actually reserve their daily mass in the sacristy directly, or they send us a request. They send to the Fabrica di San Pietro, to the Vicariate office, a request to say mass at a particular altar inside the Basilica.
How do they do that? They go on to the Fabrique of St. Peter's from the Vatican website.
Right, exactly.
My last question then, you've already mentioned some of them, but the challenges that you hope to tackle in the future.
This is a very, very nice question, but also a challenging question. I think really my, let us say, my real concern is that any person from any part of the world, any country in the world, whatever their cultural background is, whatever their religious background is, may come to this site and have such an overall extraordinary experience that, and somehow, either the beauty of this extraordinary site, the spirituality of this extraordinary site, might change something in their life.
Thanks there to Cristina Carlo Stella, General Manager of the Fabrica of St. Peter's. That's the Vatican office responsible for the maintenance and daily care of the Basilica. Well, that brings today's program to a close. I'm Tracy McClure, thanking you for joining me for the last half hour. Tune in again tomorrow at the same time and on this same channel for the next English feature program, or you can hear us at any time of the day or night by clicking on our website. That's vaticanradio.org. Just look for the English service. We'd also love to hear your comments or suggestions, so send us an email. We appreciate snail mail, too. Just send us a note to the English Service at Vatican Radio, Piazza Pia 3, Vatican City, 00120. Again, thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.